yet response mechanisms for the reluctant. We must study the expected need and be prepared. As I have said, my loftiest dream is that not one would refuse the loyalty mark. Miss Ivins, please. The first page of your folder, she began, in a precise and articulate tone, with a hint of her native Romanian dialect, long before you reach the guillotines. She paused for the chuckling in which David did not join, is a listing of the 10 world regions and a corresponding number. It is the product of a mathematical equation that identifies those regions and their relationships to His Excellency the Potentate. The loyalty mark, which I shall explain in detail, shall begin with these numbers, thus identifying the home region of every citizen. The subsequent numbers, embedded on a biochip inserted under the skin, will further identify the person to the point where every one shall be unique. Suddenly, as if in a trance, Leon rose and began to speak. Every man, woman, and child, regardless of their station in life, shall receive this mark on their right hands or on their foreheads. Those who neglect to get the mark when it is made available will not be allowed to buy or sell until such time as they receive it. Those who overtly refuse shall be put to death, and every marked loyal citizen shall be deputized with the right and the responsibility to report such a one. The mark shall consist of the name of His Excellency or a prescribed number. With that, Leon dropped heavily into his chair. Viv Ivan smiled benevolently and said, "Why, thank you, Reverend," which caused all, including Leon, to laugh. David was afraid his crashing heart and shaking hands would make him conspicuous. What if someone got the bright idea to apply the mark to the inner circle that very night? He might be in heaven before Annie knew he was dead. "We have settled on the technology," Viv continued. "The miniature biochip, with the suffix numbers embedded in it, can be inserted as painlessly as a vaccination in a matter of seconds. Citizens may choose either location, and visible will be a thin half-inch scar, and to its immediate left, in 6-point black ink, impossible to remove under penalty of law, the number that designates the home region of the individual. That number may be included in the embedded chip should the person prefer that one of the variations of the name of the potentate appear on their flash."
"Variations?"
someone asked.
"Yes. Most, we assume, will prefer the understated numbers next to the thin scar. But they may also choose from the small initials, no bigger than the numbers, NJC. The first or last name may be used, including one version of Nikolai that would virtually cover the left side of the forehead."
"For the most loyal," Nikolai said with a grin. "Someone like, say, Director Hickman, for instance." Hickman blushed, but called out, "Sign me up, Viv."
"The beauty of the embedded chip is twofold," she continued. "First, it leaves the visible evidence of loyalty to the potentate, and second, it serves as a method of payment and receipting for buying and selling. Eye-level scanners will allow customers and merchants to merely pass by and be billed or receipted."
Several whistles of admiration sounded. David's head throbbed. He raised his hand.
"Director Hasid," Viv said,
"what are you looking at in the way of timing?"
"Worried that your head won't take any more invasion just now," she said, smiling.
"I had an IV in the hand, too."
"Not to worry," she said.
"While the potentate and the former supreme commander see value in employees serving as examples to the world, you will have 30 days beginning tomorrow to fulfill your obligation."
"I'll do it tonight," someone said, "and I'm not even Hickman."
A month, David thought. A month to get out of Dodge. What would become of him and Annie and Mac and Abdullah and Hannah Palemoon? Viv said that over the next few days she would be sure each director knew his part in the rollout of images of Carpathia and the application of the mark of loyalty. Meanwhile, she said, "His Excellency has a closing comment."
"Thank you, Viv," Nikolai said. "Allow me to tell you just one story of a family I met today, and you know I met thousands. We have such a nucleus of loyal citizenry. This was a beautifully loyal Asian family named Wong."
David fought to maintain his composure. Their daughter already works for us at Buffer in Brussels. The parents are well-to-do and great supporters of the global community. The father was quite proud of his family and of his record of loyalty. But I was most impressed with the 17-year-old son, Chang. He is a boy who, according to his father, loves me and everything about the world as we see it today. He wants nothing more than to work for me here at the palace, and though he has another year of high school, would rather bring his talents our way. And such talents! I will arrange for the completion of his schooling here, because he is a genius. He can program any computer, analyze and fix any procedural or operational or systems problem. And this is not just a proud father talking. He showed me documents, grades, letters of recommendation. This kind of boy is our future, and our future has never looked brighter. That boy, David thought, would die before he took the mark.
Chapter 6. As Rayford followed the wheelchair down the hall, barely able to breathe, his mind reeled with his mistakes. Were it somehow possible to extricate himself from this, he would be the most decisive leader the Tribulation Force could imagine. They repaired to an office even smaller than the original. Pinkerton Stevens opened the door and neatly pivoted his chair so he could hold it open and leave room for Rayford and Albie to enter. He pointed Rayford to a steel-gray chair near the wall, facing a desk of the same color and material. Albie sat to Rayford's left. Stevens let the door shut and locked it, breathed something nasally about the room being secure and not bugged, then steered himself to the other side of the desk, plowing a standard chair out of the way. He maneuvered his wheelchair up and under the desk, leaned forward and rested his elbows atop it, and folded his hand and a half under his chin. Part of Rayford could hardly bear to look at the man. Another part could not take his eyes off him.
"Now then," Stevens began slowly, "Deputy Commander Elbaz, if that's your real name, you may restrap your sidearm and keep your hand off it. We're both on the same team, and you have nothing to fear. As for you, Mr. Barry, while you may be out of uniform and likely using an alias yourself, neither do you have anything to fear. You are about to be pleasantly surprised to find that the three of us are on the same team."
Rayford wanted to say, "I doubt it," but feared he would emit no sound if he tried.
"Shall we start over, gentlemen?" Stevens said. If only, Rayford thought. "Mr. Elbaz, as the superior officer, I believe it falls to you to begin our session with the proper protocol."
"He is risen," Albie said, miserably, in Rayford's opinion.
"Oh, is risen indeed,"
Stevens responded, and Rayford attributed the mispronunciation to the man's malady, whatever it was. Albie just stared at Stevens. Rayford noticed that while Albie had taken his hand off his gun, he had not fastened the strap. Rayford wondered if he could grab the gun, kill them both, and get away with Hattie.
"Commander Elbaz, you have business here, and I will let you get to it after I satisfy the curiosity on both your parts. I realize that I am difficult to look at, that you both have to be wondering what happened to me, and that as hard as I have worked on my speech, I am difficult to understand. Have either of you ever seen someone with most of his face missing?"
Both shook their heads, and Stevens placed his good thumb beneath his chin.
"Once I remove my prosthetic, I will be unable to be understood at all, and so I will not attempt to speak."
Snap! Rayford flinched as Stevens unsnapped the plastic covering under his chin. Snap! Snap! As he continued, it became clear that the prosthetic was all one piece that substituted for most of his chin, nose, eye sockets, and forehead. It was held in place by metal fasteners embedded in what was left of the original facial bones. Stevens kept it in place with his stub-fingered hand and said,
Prepare yourselves. I won't make you look long.
Albie held up a hand. Mr. Stevens, this is unnecessary. We have business here, yes, and I don't see the need to...
He stopped when Stevens pulled the piece away from his face, revealing a monstrous cavity. Only what was left of his lips hinted at anything human, and Rayford fought to keep from covering his own eyes. The man had no nose, and his entire eyeballs were exposed. Through gaps in his forehead, Rayford believed he could see through to the brain. Rayford could breathe again when Stevens refastened the appliance.
"Forgive me, gentlemen," he said, "but just as I assumed, neither of you really saw what I wanted you to see."
"And what was that?" Albie said, clearly shaken.
"Something that explains what I see on your faces."
"I'm lost," Rayford said.
"Oh, but you're not," Stevens said, with a twisted smile. "You once were lost, but now you're found. Would you like me to remove the prosthetic again and—"
"No," Rayford and Albie said in unison, and Albie added, "Just get to the point." Pinkerton folded his hands beneath his chin again, and his eyes seemed to bore into Albie.
"How did I respond when you said he is risen?"
Albie seemed to have regained his voice and composure.
"Sounded like you said, who is risen indeed?"
"That's what I said. What's your answer?"
Albie shifted and cleared his throat.
"I believe the protocol is that I say, he is risen, and that you respond, he is risen indeed."
"Fair enough. But my question remains, who is risen indeed?"
"So," Rayford concluded, "somehow he's on to me." And yet he sat silent, knowing a moment of truth had arrived, and waiting to see what would come of it.
"Humor me one more time, Commander."
Albie sighed and glanced at Rayford. Albie's phony mark sure looked real.
"He is risen," Albie muttered.
"Who is risen indeed?"
Stephen said, forcing another smile through the misshapen lips.
"Oh, for Pete's sake," Albie said, "I'm tired of this game."
"Christ!" Stevens whispered excitedly. "Come on, brothers. The answer to the question is Christ. Christ is risen indeed. I see the marks of the believer on both your foreheads. You missed mine for the horror of the rest of my face. Now look!"
He unfastened the prosthetic from the top this time and merely peeled it back. Rayford and Albie leaned forward, and there, amidst the gore, the mark was clear. As Stevens reapplied the piece, Rayford turned and grabbed Albie's head in both hands. He cupped the back with his left hand and rubbed the forehead hard with his right.
"Satisfied?" Albie said, smiling.
Rayford felt like jelly. He flopped back in his chair, panting and unable to move.
"So who are you, anyway?" Stevens said.
Rayford leaned forward.
I know who you are. I knew almost immediately, though I like the new look. But who's this character?"
Albie introduced himself. Stevens leaned forward and shook his hand. He nodded to Rayford.
"I've got Mr. Steele completely dumbfounded, don't I?"
"That's an understatement," Rayford said.
"You and I both worked for Carpathia at the same time, Rayford, and before that your son-in-law worked for me."
"Steve Plank?"
"In the flesh, or what's left of it. Crushed, chopped up, burned, and left for dead by the wrath of the Lamb earthquake. I'd been on the edge for weeks, reading Buck's stuff, realizing things about Carpathia. I decided that if Buck and other believers were right about a global earthquake, I was in at the sound of the first tremor. I was praying the prayer as the building came down."
Rayford shook his head. "But why the ruse? Why work for the GC again?"
It came to me in the hospital. No one, including me, knew who I was. When my memory returned, I made up a name and a history. That was 21 months ago, and all through a year of therapy and rehab, I had time to think about where I wanted to land. I wanted to take Carpathia down from the inside.
But why not tell anyone? Everyone thought you were dead.
The best secrets are kept between two people, providing one of them is dead. One of the most shameless stunts Carpathia pulled was how he treated Hattie Durham. I got myself into the peacekeeping force and kept my eye on her till I tracked her out here. I prayed this day would come. I'll follow orders, obey the rules, do my job, and you'll rescue her.
David panicked. After sitting through the surreal performance by Carpathia, Fortunato, and Viv Ivins, he was in line to leave with the others. But Carpathia stood by the door, accepting embraces, handshakes, kisses, and bowing from each director. The shameless Hickman fell to his knees and wrapped his arms around Nikolai's knees, weeping loudly. The potentate rolled his eyes and gave Fortunato a look that would have put a wart on a gravestone. When he was about sixth in line, David prayed desperately. What was he to do? In the flesh, he wanted to fake whatever he had to fake in order not to be found out and jeopardize the rest of the force, but he could not, would not, bow the knee to Antichrist. It was impossible that his breach of etiquette would go unnoticed. From what he could tell, it appeared he would be the only director who did not gush over the resurrected leader.
"God help me," he prayed silently. Was this the end? Should he merely bolt now and hope for the best? Or shake Carpathia's hand and say something neutral? "Glad you're feeling better after that dying thing. Welcome back." Except for his obvious disgust with Hickman, Carpathia oozed graciousness and humility as his people poured on the sugar.
"Oh, thank you. I'm grateful for your partnership and support. Great days ahead. Yes, yes."
Now second in line, David was nauseated, literally. His tender scalp vibrated against the bandages with every beat of his heart. He tried to pray, tried to be sensitive to what God wanted him to do. But as the director in front of him finally pulled away from a long embrace of the potentate, David stood there blankly. Carpathia spread his arms and said,
"David, my beloved David."
David could not move and sensed the turning heads of those nearby. Carpathia looked puzzled, seeming to beckon him. David said,
and
pitched forward. His last image, before crashing to the floor, head banging the marble, was that he had vomited all over Carpathia. "How you doing, Zeke?" Buck said. He pictured the all-black-wearing, flabby forger huddled underground at his dad's one-pump filling station in ravaged Des Plaines.
"I'm okay," came the whispered reply. "I've been reading to keep from getting bored, and I got all kinds of food down here. Kind of dark, though."
"Have you been keeping an eye on the GC?"
"Yeah, every time I hear a car, I scoot over to my monitor and watch what they do. Some of these people aren't even our real customers. They just see the pump and stop in. Then the GC car swings over from across the road and parks right in front of them."
"A Jeep?"
"No, it's a little four-door, a dark compact."
"Good."
"Why's that good, Mr. Williams?"
"Because when I come for you, I'm going to be in a white Hummer, and it'll squash a compact like a bug."
"It's not a VW, sir. That was just an expression, Zeke."
"Oh, I getcha." "So they don't pull up in front and behind the car?"
"No, there's only one GC car over there. I looked."
"You did?"
"Yeah, I know I shouldn't have, but I was real bored, so I sneaked up the stairs where I was still in the dark and could see across the way. You know, this road never really got rebuilt. They threw some asphalt on it a little over a year ago, but there was no real base, so it went to potholes, and now it's just chunks of pavement. We don't get much traffic."
"You don't think the GC knows you're there, do you?"
"Nope. And I'm real sure they don't know there's a basement. There didn't used to be. Dad and I dug it ourselves."
Where's the debris?
Out back, through the door at the back of the service bay.
Never noticed it. How close are the secret stairs to the underground?
Maybe 10 feet. It's kinda hidden in the corner.
So if I was to drive to the back of the station, I'd see a door right about in the middle of the building, a door you could get to by sneaking up the stairs and moving about 10 feet along the back wall.
Yeah.
So if you knew exactly when I was coming, you could sneak out the back without the GC stakeout guys seeing you.
They'd probably see you, though.
I'll worry about that. We don't want them to know you were ever in the underground. You come out and crawl in the back, and I'll have a blanket you can hide under.
I'll have a lot of my stuff.
That's okay. If they see me and stop me, I'll bluff my way out of it, but I'm going to try to do it in a way where they won't even know I'm there. A beep told Buck he had another call. It was Rayford. Zeke, let me call you back. It could be a while, so be packed. He pushed the button. Buck here. Buck, you're not going to believe who I just prayed with.
Hattie?
No, you'd never guess. David awoke in the palace hospital during the wee hours to someone caressing his hand.
Don't speak, she whispered.
It was Nurse Pale Moon.
You're a celebrity.
I am?
Shh. It's all over the palace that you blew chunks on Carpathia.
David was on an IV again. He felt better.
Did you change my dressing?
Yes, now be quiet.
I thought you were off duty.
So did I, but I was yanked in here because I was the one who had stitched you up, and you know no doctor was going to be dragged out of bed.
Hannah, I've got to get out of here.
No, you should have been with us a few days anyway, and now you've got the chance.
I can't, and neither can you.
He quickly whispered what he had learned at the meeting. We've got to be out of here before 30 days from today or be prepared for the consequences.
I'm prepared, David, aren't you?
You know what I mean. I've got to find my fiancé and my pilots, and if you know of any other believer's fiancé, you're attached?
The Phoenix cargo chief, Annie Christopher.
I don't know what to tell you, David. If she were here, she'd be in the system by now.
Would you check again for me? And see if you can get Mac McCollum and Abdullah Smith to visit me.
That's quite an alias, Alby, Plank said. You want me to report that a deputy commander, Elbaz, came in here with the proper credentials, and that I follow the letter of the law?
I'm so visible on the GC database, no one will even question it, Alby said. They'll probably wonder why they haven't met me yet.
And soon enough, Rayford said, I'll be enlisted and we'll make sure Alby reports to me. I just worry about compromising our inside guy, the one who sets this stuff up for us.
How will they trace it to him, or even to the palace? Alby said.
I don't know. Maybe he's precluded that, but we'll have to let him know what's happening. Plank led them out the door and down the hall, past the receptionist and into the cell area.
I heard a noise back there a minute ago, Mrs. Garner called out from the desk.
Trouble?
Something banging, that's all.
Plank led them into Hattie's door and knocked, but heard no response.
Ma'am, he called out, GC personnel are here to transport you back to Buffer.
He winked at Rayford and Alby.
May I come in, ma'am?
Plank fished for his key ring, unlocked the door, and pushed it open about an inch until it met resistance. Alby and Rayford stepped forward to help, but Plank said,
I got this.
He backed up his chair, then threw it forward, bashing into the door and pushing past the bed that had been wedged against it.
Oh, no,
he said, and Rayford stepped over him, driving his shoulder into the door to force his way in. The room was dark, but when he flipped the light switch, sparks startled him from the ceiling where the fixture had been. Light from the hall showed the fixture now on the floor, knotted at the end of a sheet. The other end was tied around Hattie's neck, and she lay there, twitching.
Tried to hang herself from a flimsy light, Plank said, as Alby leapt past him and slid up to Hattie on his knees.
He and Rayford dug and tore at the sheet until it came loose. Rayford gently turned her on her back, and she flopped like a dead woman. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dark, he saw that hers were open, pupils dilated.
She was moving,
Alby whispered, grabbing her belt and lifting her hips off the floor. Rayford plugged her nose, forced her mouth open, and clamped his mouth over hers. Her tiny frame rose and fell as he breathed into her, and Albie applied pressure to help her breathe out.
"Shut the door," Albie told Plank.
"You don't need the light?"
"Shut it," he whispered desperately. "We're going to save this girl, but nobody but us is going to know it."
Plank steered his chair to push the bed out of the way, then shut the door.
"She's got a pulse," Albie said. "You okay, Ray? Want me to take over?"
Rayford shook his head and continued until Hattie began to cough. Finally, she gulped in huge breaths and blew them out. Rayford sat heavily on the floor, his back against the wall. Hattie cried and swore.
"I can't even kill myself," she hissed. "Why didn't you let me die? I can't go back to Buffer."
She collapsed in tears and lay rocking on the floor on her knees and elbows.
"She doesn't recognize anybody," Albie said.
Hattie looked up, squinting. Rayford leaned over and turned on a small lamp.
"No, I don't," she said, peering at Albie and glancing at Rayford. "I know Commandant Pinkerton here, but who are you losers?"
Albie pointed to Rayford.
"He saved your life. I'm just his loser friend."
Hattie sat in the middle of the floor, her knees pulled up, hands clasped around them, and she swore again.
"You're not going to Buffer, Hattie," Rayford said finally, and it was clear she recognized his voice.
"What?"
she said, wonder in her voice.
"Yeah, it's me," Rayford said. "There are no secrets in this room."
"You came?"
she squealed, scrambling to him and trying to embrace him. He held her away. She looked at Plank.
"But..."
"We're all in this together," Rayford said wearily.
"I almost killed myself," Hattie said.
"Actually," Albie said, "you did."
"What?"
"You're dead."
"What are you talking about?"
"You want out of here? You want the GC off your back? You go out of here dead."
"What are you saying?"
"You called your old friend to rescue you. You refused. You were despondent. When you gave up hope and were convinced you were going to Buffer, you lost all hope, wrote a note, and hung yourself. We came to get you, discovered you too late, and what could we do? Report the suicide and dispose of the body."
"I did write a note," she said. "See?"
She pointed to a slip of paper that had fallen off the bed. Rayford picked it up and read it under the lamp. "Thanks for nothing, old friends," she had written.
"I vowed never to go back to Buffer, and I meant it. You can't win them all."
"Sign it," Rayford said. Hattie massaged her neck and tried to clear her throat. She found her pen and signed the note.
"How long can you hold your breath?" Albie asked.
"Not long enough to kill myself, apparently."
"We're going to wheel you out of here under a sheet, and you're going to have to look dead when we load you onto the plane, too. Can you pull that off?"
"I'll do whatever I have to."
She looked at Plank.
"The less you know, the better," he said. He glanced at Albie, then Rayford. "She never needs to know, as far as I'm concerned."
They nodded. Plank told them to leave the sheet the way it was, with the light fixture still embedded in one end.
"Use the other sheet from the bed to cover her, and do it now."
Rayford ripped the sheet from the bed, and Hattie lay on the bare mattress. He floated the sheet atop her and let it settle. Plank opened the door.
"Mrs. Garner," he called, "we've had a tragedy here."
"Oh, my, no,
don't come, just stay where you are. The prisoner hanged herself, and the GC will dispose of the remains."
"Oh, Commander, is that what I heard?"
"Possibly."
"Could I have done something? Should I have?"
"There's nothing you could have done, ma'am. Let's let these men do their work. Bring the gurney from utility."
"I don't have to look, do I, sir?"
"I'll handle it. Just get it for me. I'll dictate a report later."
Despite her ashen countenance and protestations, Rayford noticed that Mrs. Garner watched the body until it was loaded into the minivan. He was amazed at Hattie's ability to look motionless under that sheet. Plank agreed to call ahead to the former Carpathia Memorial Airstrip to clear the way for Deputy Commander Elbaz and his driver to pull Judy Hamilton's vehicle right up to their fighter jet in order to load a body for transport. No, they would not need any assistance and would appreciate as little fuss as possible over it. Hattie slipped back under the sheet a few miles from the airstrip, and though curious eyes peered through the windows, Rayford and Albie carried her aboard without rousing undue suspicion. Chapter 7. Buck pulled the Hummer out of the garage under the Strong building after dark, lights off. He had spent the afternoon rigging up a special connection to the brake lights and backup lights. Once in regular traffic outside Chicago, he didn't want to risk getting stopped for malfunctioning rear lights, but neither did he want those lights coming on when he braked at Zeke's place. Zeke himself was an expert at this and walked Buck through it by phone. It would be great when Zeke was tucked away at the new safe house, available to help with just those kinds of details. The brake lights were now disengaged, so with his lights on or off, Buck would have to manually illuminate them when applying the brake. A thin wire led from the back through the back seat and up to the driver's side, if he could just remember to use it. No one knew how frequently, if ever, the GC invested the time, equipment, and manpower to overfly the quarantined city their own databases told them was heavily radioactive. It didn't make sense that anyone would be near the place. If the readings were true, which David Hasid and the Tribulation Force knew was not the case, no one could live there long. Still, Rayford's plan was to come and go in his helicopter from the tower in the dark of night, and Buck or anyone else coming or going would do the same from the garage. It was tricky going because no light sources outside the Strong building were engaged in the city. Unless the moon was bright, seeing anything in the dark was almost impossible on what used to be those miles of city streets. Buck pulled away slowly, the gigantic Hummer propelling itself easily over the jagged terrain. He wanted to get used to the vehicle, the largest he had ever driven. It was surprisingly comfortable, predictably powerful, and, to his delight, amazingly quiet. He had feared it would sound like a tank. Driving around Chicago in the dark was no way to familiarize himself with the car. He needed open road and the confidence that no one was paying attention. Half an hour later, he hit the city limits and took the deserted frontage road that would deliver him into the suburbs without detection. He turned on his lights and set the manual brake light switch where he could reach it with his left hand. Near Park Ridge, a rebuilt section actually had a few miles of new pavement and a couple of working traffic lights. The rest of northern Illinois seemed to have regressed to the earliest days of the automobile. Cars made their own trails through rubble, and rain sometimes made those routes impassable. Buck saw a couple of GC squad cars, but traffic was light. When he felt safe, he tested the power of the Hummer and practiced several turns at varying speeds. The faster he went and the sharper he turned, the more violently his body was pressed against the safety belt, but it seemed nothing would make the Hummer tip. Buck found a deserted area where he was sure no one could see him, and tried a couple of fast turns even on inclines. The Hummer seemed to ask for more. With its super-wide stance, its weight, and its power, it had unmatched maneuverability. Buck felt as if he were starring in a commercial. He floored the vehicle, got it up to near 80 on packed dirt, slammed on the brakes, and turned the wheel. The anti-lock system kept him from skidding or even hinting at going over. He couldn't wait to compete with whatever toy the GC was using in its stakeout in Des Plaines. Buck had to calm himself. The idea was to pick up Zeke undetected. He considered stopping at the station like a normal customer and ramming the GC as they came to investigate, but they had phones and radios and a communications network that would hem him in. If he could find a way to approach the station from the back, lights out, they might never see him, even after he pulled away with his quarry. His phone chirped. It was Zeke. "You close by?" the young man said. "Not far. What's up?" "We're gonna have to torch this place." "Why?" "Once they figure they've busted every rebel that used to gas up here, they're gonna torch it anyway, right?" "Maybe," Buck said, "so why not let them?"
"They might search it first."
"And find what?"
"The underground, of course. I can't even think about getting all the stuff out of here that could give my dad away."
"What more can they do to him?"
"All they got him on now is selling gas without GC approval. They fine him or make him sit a month or two. If they find out me and him was running a rebel forgery biz out of here, he becomes an enemy of the state."
Good thinking. Buck never failed to be amazed at the street wisdom of the unlikely-looking Zeke. Who would have guessed that the former druggy, biker, tattoo artist would be the best phony credentials man in the business?
"And remember, Mr. Williams, we were feeding people out of here, too. Groceries, you name it. Well, you know, you bought a bunch of them. Okay, here's what I'm thinking. I rig up a timer to a sparking device. You know, it ain't the gas that burns anyway."
"I'm sorry?" Buck felt stupid. He had been a globe-trotting journalist, and a virtual illiterate was trying to tell him gasoline fires aren't what they seem.
"Yeah, it's not the gas that burns. When I was working above ground helping Dad in the station when it was legal and all, I used to toss my cigarettes in a bucket of gas we kept in the service bay."
"No, you didn't.
I swear."
"Lit cigarettes?"
"Swear to... I mean, honest. That was how we put him out. They'd hiss like you was tossing him into a bucket of water.
I'm confused.
We kept gas in there to clean our hands on. Cuts grease, you know, like if you just did an axle job and now you gotta go fill a tank or write on a credit card receipt or something.
I mean, I'm confused about how you could throw a cigarette into a container of gasoline.
Lots of people don't know that, or don't believe it.
How'd you keep from blowing yourself to kingdom come?
Well, if the bucket of gas was fresh, you had to wait a while. If you saw any of that shimmering or the fumes over it, like when you first pour it in there or when you're filling your tank, well, you don't want any open flame of any kind near that.
But once it sat and the shimmering fumes were gone, then we tossed our cigarette butts in there.
So it's the fumes.
Yeah, it's the fumes what burns.
I get it.
So, your thoughts?
See, Mr. Williams, it works the same in an engine. Like a fuel-injected engine shoots a fine spray of gas into the cylinders and the spark plugs spark and burn it, but they're not burning the spray.
The spray is emitting fumes, and that's what's in essence exploding in the cylinder, Buck said.
Now you've got it.
Good. I'm heading your way, so cut to the chase.
Okay, I moved two huge boxes of stuff out by the pile of dirt in the back, and I got one big canvas bag. All my files, my equipment, everything is there. Even had room for some food.
We have plenty of food, Zeke.
Never have enough food. Anyway, the stuff's out there waiting. I figure if you don't get seen coming, I can be waiting for you and load my stuff in there real quick before I jump in.
Sounds like a plan. Back to the torching.
Yeah, I've got auto parts down here. I cut a feed from the pipe that leads to the storage tank, which runs right by the wall we dug out here, and I hook a fuel injector to it. When I leave, I turn the spigot, the gas runs through the fuel injector, and starts spraying gasoline.
And pretty soon the underground is filled with gas.
Fumes.
Right. And you, what, toss a match down the stairs on your way out to the car?
Zeke laughed. Shh. Yeah, they can't hear me. But no, tossing a flame down here then would blow me all the way to Chicago. Save you a trip, eh?
So, how do you ignite it?
Put a spark plug on a timer. Give myself 5 minutes or so just in case. At the right time, kaboom.
Kaboom.
Bingo.
Zeke, even if I agreed, you'd never have time to rig all that up. I'm not 10 minutes away.
I figured you'd agree.
And so,
it's all done. You're kidding me.
Nope. If you're 10 minutes away, I'll set the timer for 15, and when I leave, I'll open the spigot.
Ooh, boy, you're resourceful.
I know how to do stuff. You sure do, but do me a favor.
Name it.
Set the timer for 5, but don't start it until after you've turned the spigot on your way out. Deal?
Deal.
Oh, and one more thing. Make sure I'm there before you open that spigot.
Oh, yeah, right. That would be important.
Kaboom, Zeke.
Bingo.
Call you when I get there.
Her name is not in our system, David, Nurse Pale Moon said. He tried to sit up and she shushed him.
That doesn't have to mean the worst.
How can you say that? The sun is coming up and I haven't heard from her. She'd communicate with me if she could.
David, you must calm down. This room is empty but not secure. Your friends are on their way, but you can't trust anyone else.
Tell me about it.
Hannah, you have got to get me out of here. I can't stay here another few days. There is so much I have to do before leaving New Babylon.
I can supply you with extra meds and dressings and try to make sure you're set, but you're going to be sore.
I'm not worried about that. Will you...
His throat caught and he couldn't say it.
Would you...
You want me to check the morgue? She said it with such compassion that he nearly broke down.
He nodded.
I'll be right back. If your friends get here while I'm gone, remind them there are ears everywhere.
Rayford and Albie and their human cargo from Colorado put down at a tiny airstrip near Bozeman, Montana, rather than try to get back to Kankakee without sleep. Albie bluffed and blustered the tiny GC contingent at the strip, who bought his story of transporting a criminal and let the three of them borrow a jeep to get into town. Such as it was, Bozeman had been left with few amenities, but one was a nearly deserted motel where they rented 2 rooms.
I don't guess we have to worry about you bolting, Rayford told Hattie.
Compared to Buffer, she said, the new safe house sounds like heaven.
You'll be in for the pitches of your life, he said. There are more of us, and you're going to be our prime target.
I might just listen for once, she said.
Don't say that lightly.
I don't say anything lightly anymore.
Hattie had a million questions about Pinkerton Stevens, but Rayford and Albie told her only that he is one of us. Then she wanted Albie's story, and he told of becoming a believer after a lifetime as a Muslim.
You know who I mean when I mention Tzion Ben Judah, then?
He said. Do I know? She said. I know him personally. Talk about a man who loves the unlovable.
Are you speaking of yourself, young lady?
She snorted and nodded. Who else?
Let me tell you something. I was unlovable. I was no kind of husband or father. My whole family is dead now. I was a criminal, and the only people who cared about me paid me well to get what they needed for illegal acts. I began to justify my existence when my black marketing was used to oppose the new evil world ruler. But I would not have called him Antichrist, would not even have known the term. I was in the same business when my world was merely chaotic, not so evil. My god was cash, and I knew how to get it. When Mac and Rayford needed my services, I took some comfort in the fact that they seemed to be good people. I was no longer just helping criminals. I watched them, listened to them. They were outlaws in the eyes of the global community, but to me that was a badge of honor. When all the predictions Mac and Rayford had told me began coming true, I could not admit to them I was intrigued. More than that, I was scared. If this were all true, then I was an outsider. I was not a believer. I began monitoring the internet messages of Dr. Ben Judah without telling my friends. I was full of pride, still. What struck me hardest was that Dr. Ben Judah made it so clear that God was the lover of sinners. Oh, I knew I was that. I just could hardly accept that anyone would love me. I downloaded a Bible to my computer and would switch back and forth between it and Dr. Ben Judah. I was able to see where he was getting his information, but his insights, those had to come from God alone. What I was learning went against everything I had ever heard or been taught. My first prayer was so childish that I would never have prayed it aloud in front of another living soul. I told God I knew I was a sinner, and that I wanted to believe that he loved me and would forgive me. I told him that the Western religion, for that is what it sounded like to me, was so foreign to me that I did not know if I could ever understand it. But I said to the Lord, if you are really the true and living God, please make it plain to me. I told him I was sorry for my whole life and that he was my only hope. That was all. I felt nothing, maybe a little foolish, but I slept that night as I had not slept in years. Well, do not misunderstand me. I was not sure I had gotten through to God. I was not sure that he was in fact who Dr. Ben Judah and the others believed him to be. But I knew I had done all I could. I had been honest with myself and honest with him, and if he was who I hoped he was, he would have heard me. That was the best I could expect.
Albie sat back and inhaled deeply. That's it, Hattie said. That's all?
He smiled. I thought I would pause and see if I had bored you to sleep yet.
You two are the ones who were up all night. Tell me what happened.
Well, I awoke the next morning with a feeling of expectancy. I didn't know what to make of it. Before I could even eat, I felt a deep hunger and thirsting, there is no other word for it, for the Bible. I believed with my whole being that it was the Word of God, and I had to read it. I pulled it up on my computer and read and read and read and read. I cannot tell you how it filled me. I understood it. I wanted more of it. I could not get enough. Only after midday, when I was weak from hunger, did I realize I had not eaten yet. I thanked God over and over for his word, for his truth, for answering my prayer and revealing himself to me. Occasionally I would break from my Bible reading and check to see if Dr. Ben Judah had posted anything new. He had not, but I followed some of his links to a site that walked the reader through what the rabbi calls the sinner's prayer. I prayed it, but I realized that it was what I had already done. I was a believer, a child of God, a forgiven, loved sinner.
Hattie appeared unable to speak, but Rayford had seen her this way before. Many had told her their stories of coming to faith. She knew the truth and the way. She simply had never accepted the life.
There is a reason I wanted to tell you that story, Albie said. Not just because I want to persuade you, which I do. Those among us who have found the truth long for everyone else to have it. But it was because of what you said about yourself. You said Dr. Ben Judah was one who loved the unlovable. He does, of course. This is a Christ-like quality, a Jesus characteristic. But then you referred to yourself as unlovable, and I identified with you. But more than that, Miss Durham, if I may use a phrase of Dr. Ben Judah's, often he will say that this or that truth gives the lie to certain false claims. Have you heard him say that, and do you know what it means?
She nodded.
Well, it applies to you, dear woman. I have just met you, and yet God has given me a love for you. Rayford and his family and friends speak often of you and their love for you. That gives the lie to your claim that you are unlovable.
They shouldn't love me, she said, just above a whisper.
Of course they shouldn't. You know yourself. You know your selfishness, your sin. God should not love us either, and yet he does. And it is only because of him that we can love each other. There is no human explanation for it.
Rayford sat, praying silently, desperately, for Hattie. Was it possible she was one who had for so long rejected Christ that God had turned her over to her own stubbornness? Was she unable to see the truth, to change her mind? If that were true, why did God plague Rayford and his friends with such a concern for her? Suddenly she rose and stepped to Rayford. She bent and kissed the top of his head. She turned and did the same to Albie, cupping his face in her hands.
Don't worry about me tonight, she said. I'll be here in the morning.
You have no reason not to be, Albie said. You are not really in our custody. In fact, you are dead.
Anyway, Rayford said, standing and stretching, where would you bolt to? Where would you be safer than where we're taking you?
Thanks for saving my life, she said as she turned to head for her room.
When she shut the door, Rayford said, I just hope this wasn't for nothing. They heard her door open and shut and her moving about in her room.
It wasn't, Albie said.
Rayford was bone-weary, but as he disrobed for bed, he thought he heard something over the sound of Albie's shower. From the adjoining room, he thought he heard voices. He moved closer to the wall. Not voices, just one. Crying, sobbing, wailing. Hattie, muffled, apparently with her face buried in a pillow or blanket. As he drifted off to sleep half an hour later in the bed across from Albie's, Hattie's lament still wafted through the wall. Rayford heard Albie turn and pat his pillow, then settle back.
God, the little man whispered, save that girl.
Buck drove straight past the little filling station, pretending not to notice the GC stakeout car amidst a small grove of trees across the road. He didn't even slow so as not to attract attention. If he had to guess, he thought just two GC guards were in the car. He phoned Zeke. Any more activity?
Nope. Was that you who just passed? Nice rig.
I'm going to circle way around and see if I can come in from the back with my lights off. Might take 10 minutes. I'll call you when I'm in position. Buck drove until he couldn't see even the outline of the station in his rearview mirror, assuming the GC could no longer see him either. He cut his lights and took a right, slowly feeling his way over rough ground. He was a couple of miles from the station, and he wanted to be sure he didn't find a hidden fence or culvert that would mess up the Hummer. At one point, after taking two more rights and thus heading in the general direction of the back of the station, he felt the vehicle dip and hoped he hadn't found a hole too deep to pull out of. When the front grille hit something solid, he hit the brake and briefly turned on the headlights. He shut them off again quickly, hoping the GC hadn't seen anything in the distance. Buck saw that he needed to back up and swing left around a 5-foot-high or so mound of dirt and boards. He wanted to turn on his brights and be able to see if anything else obstructed his path to the back of the station, but he didn't dare. By the time he could make out the shape of the place, he slowed to just a few miles an hour and crept along in the uneven dirt, bouncing, jostling, and, he hoped, not sending up too much dust. It was a starry night, and if the GC noticed anything blocking the sky, they were sure to come nosing around the back. Buck phoned Zeke.
I hear you, Zeke said.
You hear me? From inside? That can't be good.
That's what I was thinking. You ready for me?
Better come quick. Carrying anything?
Yeah, one more bag. Figured I might as well not leave anything I could bring.
Good thinking. Come on.
Gotta open the spigot and turn on the timer.
For how long?
5 minutes.
Anything on the monitor?
They're just sitting.
Good. Let's go. Buck knew he could come back the way he came, and though the ride would be pretty rugged, he estimated he could do as much as 40 miles per hour. But in case the GC could hear the Hummer as well as he could, he jumped out and started loading the car to save time. The inside light stayed dark as he opened the door to get out, and he left it open. He opened the back door on the far side and crept around to start lifting. The first box was almost too heavy, and it was all he could do not to cry out under the weight. He heard Zeke coming up the stairs. Buck lugged the box onto the back seat from the car door farthest from the station's back door, feeling every sore fiber from his recent ordeal. When he got back around the car to grab the other box, figuring Zeke could load the bag he was carrying and the one on the ground at the same time, he nearly ran into the young man, startling him. Zeke grunted. Buck tried to shush him, but Zeke dropped his bag and lurched back inside, slamming the door. Buck heard him lumbering down the stairs. Now they were making way too much noise. Buck yanked open the station door and called out desperately as quietly as he could, "Zeke, it's just me. Come on, man, now."
"Oh, man," Zeke hollered. "I thought it was them. The timer's going, the gas is spitting, and they're coming, Buck. I can see them on the monitor."
Buck turned and opened the back door nearest the station. He picked up the bag that had been waiting and the one Zeke had dropped and hurled them across the back seat. He left the door open and jumped behind the wheels, slamming his door and putting the Hummer in gear. Zeke barreled out and dove into the back seat, knocking one of the bags out the other side where Buck had left the door open. Buck floored the accelerator, but Zeke yelled, "We can't leave that bag. It's got lots of stuff we need." The door had started to close when Buck took off, but when he hit the brake, it swung the other way and creaked against the hinges. "Get it!" he screamed, and Zeke scrambled over the stuff and out onto the ground, his foot dragging a bag out too. And here came the GC Mobile around the station in front of Buck.
"Go, go!" Zeke yelled, forcing himself into the back seat with both heavy bags tucked under his arms.
The door was still open, but Buck had to move. He gunned the engine and slammed into the GC car, driving it back against the station as his back door shut. The guards had weapons out and appeared to be reaching for door handles. Buck knew he couldn't outrace bullets, so he threw the Hummer into reverse, floored it, and the monstrous vehicle climbed the hill of debris near the door. Buck stopped at the top as they teetered some 12 feet above their pursuers. He shifted into drive, and when the GC saw the vehicle start to move, they lowered their weapons and dove out of the way. The Hummer dropped almost vertically, ramming the hood of the little car and blowing both of its front tires. The engine gushed water and steam, and Buck could tell he had rendered the GC vehicle useless. Rather than look for the guards, he merely backed up 6 feet, whipped the wheel right, and sped off into the night. Zeke had somehow got the door shut, but neither he nor Buck had time to buckle in. As the Hummer lurched across the plains at high speed, both men were thrown around like rag dolls, their heads hitting the ceiling, their shoulders banging the doors. Buck skidded to a stop.
"What?" Zeke demanded.
"Buckle up." They both did, and off he flew again. Fewer than 5 minutes later, as Buck found a route that would lead him back to Chicago, the sky behind them went from night to day in a massive orange ball of flame. A few seconds later, the sound and the shock rocked the car anew. Buck, high from the adrenaline, knew how close they had come to dying. Zeke, laughing like a child, kept turning in his seat and looking back at the flaming horizon.
"Well," he said, cackling, "so much for that job."
Chapter 8. Mac and Abdullah sat sullenly in David's hospital room, whispering.
30 days, Mac said over and over. "Hard to believe."
"No way of staying around here," Abdullah said. "Not that I'll miss it."
"Well, in some ways I will."
"I know I will," David said, coming to full attention whenever he heard footsteps in the corridor. "So much we can do from the inside that we'll never be able to pull off from the outside."
Mac let out a sigh that made him sound old and tired. "David, this may sound like I'm kissing up to the boss, but you know I wouldn't kiss up to you if you were the potentate. But we both know you can do anything technologically. Get yourself healthy and do whatever you got to do to keep tabs on this place from anywhere in the world. Isn't that doable?"
"Theoretically," David said, "but it won't be easy. Somehow you got this place bugged, sliced, and diced. Why can't you access computers here the way you did that building in Chicago where we're all likely going to wind up?"
David shrugged. "It's possible. I can't imagine psyching myself up to get it done. Not without any."
David caught the glance between Mac and Abdullah.
"What?" he said. "You know something you're not telling me?"
Mac shook his head. "We're just as worried as you. Makes no sense. No way she wouldn't let you know where she was if she could."
He paused, and a twinkle played at his eyes.
"Unless she locked herself in that utility room again."
David laughed in spite of himself. Annie was one of the most disciplined, button-down employees he'd ever had, but one out-of-character stunt she pulled would hang over her head as long as she lived. The way Hannah Pale Moon knocked at the half-open door told David way more than he wanted to know. A sob rose in his throat. Max stood, and David nodded to him.
"Come in," Max said.
David tried to ignore the small, corrugated box in Hannah's hands and desperately searched her face for some trace of optimism. She approached slowly and set the box near David's feet. "I am so sorry," she said, and David collapsed inside. His pain, his fatigue melted away, overwhelmed by grief and loss too great to bear. He groaned and drew his fists up under his chin, turning from his friends, rolling onto his side, drawing his knees up and folding in on himself.
"Lightning?"
The question forced its way past his constricted throat. "Yes," Anna whispered. "There would have been no pain or suffering." Grateful for that, David thought, at least not for her.
"David," Max said huskily, "me and Smitty will be right outside."
"I'd appreciate it if you could stay,"
David managed, and he heard them sit again.
"I have a few of her personal effects," Hannah said.
David tried to sit up, feeling the cursed dizziness. "It's just her purse and phone, jewelry and shoes." David finally sat up and put the box between his knees. His breath caught at the charred smell. The phone had melted in spots. One shoe had scorched holes in the heel and toe.
"I have to see her," he said. "I wouldn't recommend it," Anna said.
"David, no," Mac urged.
"I have to. She's not really gone and never will be unless I know for sure. This is her stuff, but did you see her, Hannah?"
The nurse nodded.
"But you didn't know her. Had you ever seen her?"